From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how the group Girls Who Code is looking specifically at communities that are behind the technology curve.
Later, a new game app hopes to get people interested in Milwaukee's water resources.
These yellow sites are the human stories, and blue sites are things that give us a little bit more connection to external resources, like the Bradford Buoy.
A conversation with the suburban founders of a new urban charter school.
We used our lack of knowledge specific to education to our advantage, we feel. We really didn't take anything for granted.
And a blogger encourages women to change the face of history by sharing their personal stories.
I saw this need to say, like, this has happened to me, this is my life, and to have it validated in words and on a page.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. By 2020, there will be 1.4 million jobs available worldwide in computing-related fields. U.S. graduates are on track to fill a respectable 29% of those jobs, but U.S. women will fill just 3%.
Given that tech is among the fastest-growing economic sectors in the country, an organization called Girls Who Code wants to up the percentage of female participants. Their mission is simple: close the gender gap in technology. They do it by working with girls between 11 and 17 because that's where they say the gender gap in tech first becomes the widest.
It seems to be working. Girls Who Code founder Reshma Saujani has seen her organization grow from 20 girls in New York City 5 years ago to over 40,000 girls in all 50 states today. It's all in service to the organization's stated goal of creating the largest pipeline of female engineers in the United States. Lake Effect contributor Eden Herbert caught up with Saujani to find out more.
So basically in the 80s, you had about 37% of computer science graduates were women. And today that number is less than 18% at a time where there's like 500,000 open jobs in computing and technology. So we want to close that gap.
And what are the goals or values you're trying to instill in your participants? And what's really the need you're seeking to fill?
Well, look, I think right now so many more American women are the head of their household. You know, they're the ones who pay the mortgage, who put food on the table. And day by day, you know, there's more and more jobs that are in the computing field, and women are being left behind. And so from an economic perspective, it's really important to make sure that women have a chance at getting these high-paying jobs. I think the second thing is that technology affects everything we do. So we want to find a cure to cancer. If we want to do something about climate change, it's, you know, we need technologists. And if half of our population are opting out of being technologists, that's a problem because we need that innovation. And so, you know, we think that that's like another big reason why we want to solve this problem.
There are places like Silicon Valley and the Boston area that are seen as much bigger tech hubs than places like Milwaukee, like where we are. And we're kind of considered a little left behind on the curve. So I was wondering, how does that work for Girls Who Code, differing based on where it's being done?
Look, I mean, I think we are, you know, I think that while there's been a lot more tech growth in like Silicon Valley and New York and Boston, I think places like Milwaukee are like becoming booming tech sectors, again, because technology is a part of everything we do. And so that's why we have a 50-state strategy. We don't just want to be in the coast. You know, we want to be in the middle of the country. You know, I was born in Chicago, Illinois. You know, I have a special place in my heart for the Midwest. And so, you know, we have, you know, like probably over 10 to 20 clubs, you know what I mean, in Wisconsin. And so we're growing nationally, and we're really, especially right now, partnering with school districts and libraries and communities that are in the Midwest, that are in the Rust Belt, right, that are in places where not only is there an access gap, but like, entire industries are being replaced through automation, right? And so we need to make sure that especially girls in those communities like have a shot at learning coding. And Girls Who Code oftentimes from many communities is like the only place in space where they can do that.
And you're touching on the really big kind of backbone of what you guys do, how you operate, which is through the community support. But I'm wondering, how do your programs operate? Really, do you find any issues in cities that don't have as many tech opportunities like in Milwaukee?
Hmm. You You know, well, so we have two programs, right? We have these summer immersion programs. We build, you know, we build classrooms in tech companies, and we host them over the summer. So those summer programs are harder to establish in places like Milwaukee because there's not an, you know, like a tech ecosystem. But we're not letting that deter us, right? And we're still looking for partners to help build those, you know, build those summer programs. And then, you know, we have after-school clubs where we rely either on volunteers that come from industry or who know how to code to come into the classroom and teach, or we train a teacher. Like, you know, we have teachers who are art teachers, who are science teachers, who are, you know, gym teachers, who have a desire to learn how to code, who are, like, teaching the Girls Who Code Club. And so, you know, to be honest, I don't feel like there is any impediment that we've reached besides access. So I think it's hard to be in a school that doesn't have Wi-Fi, right, or that doesn't have computers, because you need a computer and Wi-Fi to learn how to code and learn how to wireframe, but it makes it a little bit more challenging. So, but we're still kind of trying to figure out how to close that gap. And part of the way we're doing this, we have a 13-book series coming out with Penguin where, you know, we have a nonfiction book for girls kind of ages 9 to 12 where you learn kind of the fundamentals of coding and computer science. We're trying to figure out every barrier and kind of break through it.
And you talk about these after-school programs, even summer programs. There's so many that exist. How exactly are you getting the girls interested in your specific organization?
So the code is awesome. You know, I think that, like, girls have an amazing time. They make new friends. They learn something interesting. They build apps on problems that they care about, and they tell their friends about it. So much of this movement is a girl-led movement that girls have told their friends, like, hey, this is cool. Like, I tried it. I did it. I liked it. You should, too.
So you're relying a lot on the kind of the word-of-mouth approach.
Yeah. And but that's what we always say for us, is we really, a lot of what we do is build a sisterhood, you know, and get, you know, get girls to, like, they're learning a superpower that they want to share with another girl.
I'm wondering, now that you're national and you do have the name recognition, if it's any different in your recruiting process in terms of participants and both volunteers.
You know, I think it's only because we're super ambitious, right? We want to get coding to every single girl. And so, yeah, we get a lot of interest from people. But we want, you know, we want a Girls Who Code Club in every school, you know, and we want to teach millions of girls how to computer program. So in that case, you know, we still have to do a lot of kind of recruiting work because I think the goals that we've set are really high.
Yeah, 40,000 in the first 5 years, right?
Yeah, and we want to get to 100,000 in the next year and a half.
Wow, and is that seeming very likely?
Yes. You know, I think it. Ask me in 6 months. But yeah, I mean, we always. I think it's important in life to set really high goals. You fail, you fail. But at least you're moving towards something that is, like, audacious.
And that's a perfect transition into the next question I wanted to ask, because in a lot of your interviews, you speak of this idea that we need to socialize imperfection and that a lot of advancements get held back because girls hold a stigma that they have to be perfect. So what process are you using to implement the socialization of imperfection?
It's a great question. So I'm, like, in the process of writing a book and doing a lot of research and thinking about this and talking to people. Look, I think the first thing is that, I don't know if you feel this way, but, like, I know for me, like, at an early age, I thought I was good at certain things and I was bad at other things. And that the things that I wasn't that good at, that I would never be good at them. And I, you know, but there may have been things I loved, like gymnastics, right, that I just stopped doing because when I couldn't get a cartwheel right the first couple of times, that didn't feel good. So I think part of what I'm trying to teach girls to do is, like, actually, like, don't pull yourself out of subjects or activities or opportunities where you're not number one, right? Like, sit in that space where you may just be average, but you love it anyway. And I think that that overcomes, like, this idea that there's a mindset, right? That I'm either fixed at doing something, or I'm either really good at doing something, or I'm not good at doing something, and I can't learn to get better. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So just to make sure I'm getting this right, through this process, you're explicitly identifying that there is, that perfection is the holdback in the progress?
I think it is. I think that we teach girls to be perfect. We reward them for being liked. We reward them for doing things perfectly. And so when they try something that doesn't go exactly right, they're not comfortable. They're like afraid of rejection, right? They don't raise their hand for things that they feel like they're not an expert in. So this means that they, you know, stick in careers that they should have left 10 years ago, right? That they feel kind of rejection and disappointment because they're not living a joyful life because they're not doing the thing that they want to do. They're doing the thing that they think they're good at. And so much of this is like, I want to unteach that. And not just because, not just for business leadership reasons, but I think for real health reasons. You know, there's a real like suicide epidemic that's happening. My friend Rachel Simmons is writing a book about this, you know, on college campuses, where you have young women who are literally killing themselves because they feel like they're not perfect. And we need to unteach that.
So there's one thing to be able to get up there and say that perfection is the problem, but do you think a lot of these girls are actually able to identify within themselves that there is a social stigma to never mess up as a woman and that they're kind of all playing into that?
I mean, I think so. I've been trying. I did this graduation speech about this whole idea of credentials. You know, I spent my whole life really chasing, you know, a Harvard degree or a Yale degree. And like when I got all the credentials that I thought would make me happy, I still wasn't happy. And I was actually incredibly sidetracked in terms of like the thing that I wanted to pursue in my life, which was public service. So I think that like, yes, I think that we are, as women, when we talk about it, become self-aware, like, wow, I really do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was on a panel with Veronica Roth, who was the author of Divergent. She was telling this beautiful story about how she was in a, you know, a voice lesson with her coach. And, you know, her coach kept saying to her, like, just let go. You know what I mean? Like, be free. Like, and she, even in a room of just her and her coach, she just couldn't let go. So she was so self-conscious of what her voice sounded like. So how do you unteach that? And I think you can. And I think part of it is just being aware of, like, wow, I do that. Like, I never knew for, like, 30 years of my life that all I was doing was, like, I knew I was chasing credentials, but nobody told me that that was wrong. That if I kept doing that, I would be unhappy. And so hopefully I'm giving a message to a lot of young women that they haven't really, that they know they're doing, but they haven't really heard yet.
Yeah, I have to tell you that while I was going through all of your interviews and reading about this specific topic about imperfection, that I personally have gotten so far and have realized that that is exactly what it is with me too, that it was this fear of not being perfect that's like probably stopped me from doing a lot of things. And it was really weird to be able to identify that because I never wanted to put myself in that category before that. But to be able to say that, I think that's like kind of freeing a little bit. And
yeah, it's totally freeing.
Yeah, and after you can identify that and say, like, screw it, that's not going to be me anymore, I think that makes so much of a difference. So
I think so, too. That makes me happy. I think so, too. I feel like it's done that for me in my life as a 40-year-old, right? It's like I'm so much happier, freer, now that, you know, I don't care as much.
Yeah.
Right? Of, like, what other people think or, like, if I look stupid doing something or... You know, I don't know. I feel like I missed out on things in my life, right? Because I cared too much.
Exactly. And that's your whole point. Like, you don't want that to be the case anymore. You want girls to be just as confident as anybody else to be able to say, I don't care about failing. I can do it just as well as anybody else.
Right.
So we talked about this a little bit, but I'm hoping you can go a little bit more in depth. What are you hoping each girl walks away from Girls Who Code with? And in terms of progress for your organization, how are you measuring your success?
Yeah. So I hope every girl walks away with like bravery and confidence and a new love of coding or just a feeling like, wow, I did something that I thought I could never do. And she takes that philosophy and that strength and that puts that into whatever else in her life. You know, we measure success by how many of our girls are actually going on to major or minor in computer science because that's the needle that one of the needles we wanted to move. And we're also looking at, like, what's the influence Girls Who Code is having on someone's leadership. Like, I have so many girls who are like, wow, like, this changed my life. Like, and it opened my eyes up to things I never knew. And it opened my eyes up to different opportunities. I made new friends. Like, I was feeling really self-confident. And I just, you know, it made me feel strong and brave and fearless. And, you know, that's powerful for us.
So in the end, it's not necessarily about making sure that all of the girls that participate in Girls Who Code actually go into coding or technology. For you, what I'm gathering is it's more about that they're walking away with all of this confidence that they should have already had.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's bigger than the coding part. Because the thing is, like, let's just say you go through a program, you minor in computer science, but then you go on to be, you know, a doctor or, you know, you're an artist. And then one day you have an idea to build or create something that you know you're going to probably need some engineers to help you create or build. And all of a sudden now you understand their language. And so you feel confident in your idea and like putting your idea into life because you don't feel like there's a language out there that you don't understand.
Now, from speaking with you, it's obvious that you have an extreme passion for helping women succeed. And I'm wondering, what is your next venture beyond Girls Who Code, because I can't see you sitting idle.
Well, I really want to solve the problem. I mean, I'm super psyched about the work that I'm doing. I want to go really deeper into bravery, so I'm excited about my book that's going to come out in a while. I want women to, like, not only reach their fullest potential, but to feel free and liberated to be and live however they want to. And I want to, like, share some of the lessons that I feel like I've learned in my life personally in Girls Who Code to help women do that.
That's a perfect wrap-up.
Good.
Reshma Shajani, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Reshma Shajani is the founder of Girls Who Code, a national organization that hopes to close the gender gap in technology. You can find out more about the group at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll stick with tech and learn about how a gaming app is helping Milwaukeeans learn more about water. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Water is so much a part of our lives in southeastern Wisconsin, yet many of us don't know as much as we could about our lakes and rivers.
Since no one likes to be lectured, a local team has come up with a novel way to educate and inspire people to learn and care about Milwaukee's water. The app they've created is called Water Story MKE, and it was designed by Reflow, a nonprofit dedicated to water sustainability.
Water Story MKE will be introduced to the public later this month through a scavenger hunt called the Great Water Race, held at six locations around the city. Lake Effect Susan Bentz met Michael Tim, one of the game's creators, at Bradford Beach, one of the sites that it explores.
It is place-based, kind of like Pokemon Go is place-based, where you go around the city and different content pops up when you explore different sites. And we've gamified that tour component so that you're not only exploring the area and revealing green infrastructure, water history that's relevant to a place, but giving you kind of game credit to keep going and explore more. So the more you explore, the more points you get. And in an event that we're hosting on July 22nd, the top three teams will get prizes for the most points that they get. So it should be a fun way to launch the app.
I know you've worked on different projects to raise awareness of the importance of, like, Michigan, the Great Lakes, how our native species are doing, the stormwater impact, all of that. So what specifically, was it the Pokemon Go that sort of got you thinking about this approach?
No, actually, we've been working on this for long before Pokemon Go, but Pokemon Go helps us to communicate about it, because when you say, oh, place-based mobile app, what are you talking about? And then when you say, it's like Pokemon Go for Milwaukee Water Stories, people get that. I'm interested in games, and I'm interested in engaging the public around things that don't always hold our interest. So in the course of becoming part of what was the Games Learning Society conference a couple years ago, attending one of those, I learned about a software platform based out of Madison called ARIS, Augmented Reality Interactive Storytelling, that led me down the path of figuring out, oh, we could actually do this. Like, you can use the tools that are available to make a place-based mobile app. Observing how humans behave with respect to mobile devices and how they're always seducing our attention, and wanting to aim that at something that reconnects us with the landscape, that reconnects us with our history, that reconnects us with each other and in my interest, water, and how water then can connect citizens and people throughout the city. So that was, the genesis was really that idea and the interest in using gameplay and really interest in sharing stuff that's hidden in plain sight. That's another attraction for me.
So give an example of that, Michael.
When you visit Bradford Beach, there are a number of rain gardens that are between the bike path and the beach. And I noticed that a lot of people will walk or run or bike by and not really give them second mind. But those are there for a reason. They have a story. And through the app, when you visit the rain garden, you get a piece of that story. And when you visit all of them, you kind of get the whole story. If the app can cause you to pause and reflect on what you're seeing and then give you a little bit of context about that, then I've done my job to help you to ask more questions down the road and to normalize the idea of green infrastructure, which is just emulating nature's practices to hold water on site rather than passing it on to someone to be someone else's problem.
So should we walk over to one of those rain gardens and you can show me how the
works? Sure, we can do that. You see, the blue dot is me moving towards the rain garden, and when we close in on it, we're going to get a little ding dong, which is dependent on the GPS satellites. Okay.
That's the ding dong.
That's the ding dong. And then we get this little, okay, rain garden. Sandra McClellan discusses the value and function of green infrastructure in an interview at Bradford Beach.
Green infrastructure is just this a little very piece. General term for using natural systems to kind of capture water.
So you get, yeah.
So you videoed her right down here, and Sandra McClellan is a, you know, well-known scientist with the School of Freshwater Sciences.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so part of it is blending the science end of green infrastructure. What is it? Why is it here? What's the value of it? And then for everyone that they visit, they get another point, which is driving them on to be aware that, oh, there's more of these, and this is the extent of them, and this is where they are. We also worked with Jabril Farage, a local journalist, and he did some really excellent work sharing the story of the transformation in and around the 30th Street corridor in Milwaukee. And so that's really our premier video content, which focuses on the transformation at Cream City Farms, which is an urban farm in 30th and Brown, which historically was a contaminated industrial site, but has been remediated by a number of partners, including the City of Milwaukee, MMSD, the engineering firm GZA, Reflow, and others. Mm-hmm. And David Johnson has set up a farm there, and it uses rainwater that runs off the site and is collected in an underground cistern for irrigation. So it's a really fascinating location and a kind of a keystone for the launch of our event on the 22nd.
And 30th Street Corridor, because all of this feeds ultimately one way or the other into the lake.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, we're all connected. And that's what this is all about, is reminding us and showing us how things are all connected.
We're being called.
So at this point, we're near the lifeguard station at the foot of the beach. And last summer, there is this event that the Bradford lifeguards, or all the lifeguards in Milwaukee County do, where they have this race, and they go off and like they do this crazy swim, like half mile swim. And so I was here to document some of that to kind of give the place-based color to this location, that there's stuff that happens here and it happens cyclically. And this is a human connection to this space. If we value this resource, then what actions are we taking to try to steward and protect it? So rather than being heavy-handed about you, thou shalt not, this is a way to remind us of how we're connected and how important it is to take those other actions.
And then how wide of a geographical, Bradford Beach would be one, 30th Street Corridor would be another, that
Correct.
Sort of thing?
So the event on July 22nd focuses on six of these sites. It starts at Cream City Farms in the 30th Street Corridor and ends at Bradford Beach.
Clever.
So there's the brewery neighborhood is the site after Cream City Farms. The lakefront brewery area is the site after the brewery neighborhood. Then the River Revitalization Foundation area just south of the former dam.
One of the hardest things to say in the world, and he did it.
And then the lakefront Flushing Station, which is better known as the Colectivo by the Lake, because of the great museum that MMSD has curated there, we have a gamified component there before you end up down at Bradford Beach. Long term, and if people are really ambitious, there's also other points of interest around the city that we call treks that are arranged thematically by things like green infrastructure, urban agriculture, water business. So if you take a bike to the event and you go off the beaten track a little bit to visit those sites, you might just edge out the other players into points value. But really, for the event on the 22nd, there's a lot to experience at just those six sites.
You envision this, Michael, as being an app that you will be adding to over time?
That's correct.
So how are you going to do that? We're like, this right. is going to be a lifelong with mission.
With a lot of support. And so we're looking forward to the support of a number of partners down the road. There's interest from the folks at the Watermarks Project, which is involving New York-based artist Mary Miss to create place-based art in the city of Milwaukee. And so we've had a number of discussions with them, and we'll be talking with them about how to merge our efforts into a really awesome app experience long term.
Michael Tim is one of the creators of the place-based digital scavenger hunt called Water Story MKE. It debuts later this month. You'll find information on the July 22nd kickoff event at WUWM.com.
You can also find a conversation there that we had with the artist Michael Tim mentioned, Mary Miss.
Up next, we'll hear from the two founders of Pathways High School, the only new charter school in Milwaukee this fall. Lake Effect returns right after this on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're often told that if we don't like something, change it. And that's exactly what Julia Burns and Amber Regan are doing. The pair of Wauwatosa mothers serve as two of the co-founders for Pathways High School. It's the only new charter school that will open in Milwaukee this coming fall.
Burns and Regan say their school will focus on project-based learning and teaching kids how to think, a focus they say traditional education lacks nowadays. But the twist in the story is neither woman has experience as an educator.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello sat down with the duo to get a sense for how they'll go about what they hope to accomplish in year one. First, we'll hear from Amber Regan, who describes the genesis of their idea.
Julia and I have been involved with Destination Imagination for a long time. It's a team-based competition. I call it competitive creativity. And we really saw, after so many years of coaching our own children as well as teams, that any student could learn in a project-based environment. And the project-based learning really pushed some kids in really fun and exciting ways. So we were trying very hard to get it brought into our public schools. We both believe very strongly in public education. Julie had a friend that had Ted Dindersmith have a day open. And so he came and spoke in Tosa to a bunch of Destination Imagination parents. And at the end of it, you kind of left with this feeling of, now what? What do we do next? And shortly after that, we saw the first ad that we saw for the XQ Super School project. So it was very much this kind of natural layup of, well, there you go. There's your next.
Before we continue, can you kind of explain XQ Super School? Because people might not know what that is.
Sure. XQ Super School was a challenge to the public to reimagine public high school, and it was developed by Emerson Collective. That's the philanthropy that is run by Lorene Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow. And she put out a call to the nation to reimagine public high school in September of 2015. And the initial concepts for a reimagined high school were due November 15th of 2015. And that was the first foray that we made into that challenge.
Tell me what that process was like then. What happened after that, and where did you go from there?
Well, it was a very intensive and comprehensive process, giving us the framework and the deadlines to create our charter application for UW-Milwaukee. It was a multi-step process whereby we needed to research extensively innovative models in education, talk with experts, talk to business and community leaders, capture student voice. We conducted 4 group student interviews that were student-led to really understand what they felt would be vital for their dream high school, what things we should not replicate, what we should avoid. And it was a very enlightening process, very rewarding to hear a lot of the ideas that we had came back to us from the students to say, yes, we were on the right track with the concept we put forth, which was a personalized project-based learning high school.
And you were mentioning your charter with UWM. A lot of people have probably heard the term charter school, but might not be familiar with what that actually means and how those schools come to be. So can you guys explain a little bit about what that process is like and what it means to have a charter from UWM?
The most important thing is that we are a public high school. We are a regional public high school because of our charter through UWM. So a regional high school means we are pulling students by intention from the city of Milwaukee as well as the counties. For us, we are a diverse by design high school, and the UWM chartering process allowed us to become a public high school serving the entire region.
Your school is located in the city, right? Can you explain where you're located and a little bit about the zip codes that you're pulling from?
So our temporary location is on 4th and Walnut.
So you're right off of King Drive.
Yes, right off of King Drive. Our students currently are coming from as far away as Sussex, Cedarburg, obviously Wauwatosa. I will have 2 students there, as well as the downtown zip codes. We have about 20 students from the highest poverty zip codes in the city. We also wanted to be located downtown because our design is project-based and personalized, but we really want to a strong connection to industry. So our projects will be connected to industry to become very relevant to the student, but also the community of Milwaukee.
So we're throwing around all these education terms, project-based learning, charters, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that neither of you has a traditional education background. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Correct.
Okay, so... But your parents, so you understand kids. We heard about how you got the idea for this, but like what sorts of supports are you getting? Because I'm assuming some of this stuff is not familiar to you guys because of the lack of that background. So who's supporting you in this and helping you start the school, helping you learn some of these terms or some of the organizational things that you might not have thought of when you first thought about starting Pathways?
We used our lack of knowledge specific to education to our advantage, we feel. We really didn't take anything for granted. I think there's a tremendous amount of inertia built into the education model that we have. It's been around for 130 plus years. And if you've grown up in that model and you've been educated at many of the teaching colleges, there is a tendency to take things for granted and perhaps have blinders on regarding innovative models. And so we really took the opportunity to learn from experts and best practices across the country. We studied innovative models within Wisconsin, across the U.S., and outside our country. Talked to numerous people, you know, some amazing schools we visited, High Tech High in San Diego, the Denver STEM School and Academy. So we tried to take the best that we could find from these innovative models, and we always saw a common thread in these models, and that was rigorous learning through relevant work, and in many cases, responsive to industry as well. So Iowa Big is one of the school models that we studied. They're in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and they don't take on projects for students unless they have a business sponsor. And so the level of engagement of students is so high because they're doing real work for real clients, and they're developing skills that will make them much more marketable when they go to seek careers in the marketplace. And so we really have seen this strong tie and belief that education is economic development, and we can't be divorcing the two. And I think traditionally we have done that.
And the deficit really is in a system that the children are telling us isn't working for them. Industry is telling us isn't working for them. You know, so we like to, because of the way we're wired, to go find the experts to support our ideas, to become lifelong learners and to model what we want the students to do, building relationships with new people, understanding where their problems are, and sharing, maybe oversharing, where and how we came to this model.
There is such a contentious relationship, especially in Milwaukee, with all of these different sectors of education, and I think you're the only new charter school actually opening this year.
That's correct.
But there are so many, and there's so many options for people. And it feels like because of the contentious relationship, people kind of all have to volley for their school or duke it out to like get kids. And do you feel like you have to do that at all?
Well, I would say one of the things that we're trying to do is we've recognized what you're describing, and we've, you know, the kind of the analogy we use is people are fighting over pieces of a pie rather than figuring out how to grow the pie. And we feel strongly that, especially based on the research and the schools we visited, that there is so much opportunity here for us to grow the pie that our energy is really focused towards that, because anything that is not about sharing what we've learned and about trying to improve education for all of the students in the region, really we're talking about the M7 region, that is not a good use of time.
And we spoke with several suburban superintendents of schools, and they were all very excited to be able to come into our school and show their school boards, this is what it can look like. And we say all the time, you know, please tell us what we're doing wrong and we'll show you what is actually working for us, as well as the ugly parts, you know, because that's how we all learn.
So you guys, your first day of school is at the end of August, right?
Correct. August 28th. Yep.
Okay. And you mentioned, Amber, that you guys are in a temporary building for the next 2 years. So what do you have left to do before school starts?
We definitely have a punch list at this point. We're still accepting students if they want to enroll. We're really trying to get that balance of diversity. We'll have an open house on July 29th. It's a Saturday. The location should be finished then, so it'll be a really pretty fancy thing to walk through and get to see what it looks like. It's really coming together nicely.
I can vouch for that. I was there and I saw it the other day. It looks beautiful.
So that'll be done by then. And then, you know, the project selection's been done. We're just really planning very carefully this first year of projects. You know, we've got our student handbooks done. We've got our grading policies done. Our website is in transition, but it'll be prettier by the end of the month, I think.
And what about staff? How is staffing looking right now?
We're pretty set.
Yeah, all of our core staff, we have our principal hired and then our core teachers, a humanities teacher that teaches English language arts and social studies or history, paired with a science teacher. In our first year, we're starting with physics.
And then on top of that, we have a teacher that is dedicated to IT. So she supports both of those teachers in every project to make sure we're really getting a rich IT experience for the students, coding, website design, gaming. But also the, you know, even for the physics down to the how you work the measurements and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. And then also as a supporting teacher too, like the IT teacher is our makerspace and blended learning teacher. And he is very much infusing the aesthetic elements, the art and the making into all of the projects as well.
Yeah, we should mention that. It's got to be close to half of the space that you have is dedicated to makerspace. Does that sound about right?
That's about right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And now, and I know you mentioned it too, but you both have a student or a couple students starting at the school in the fall. So taking off your school leader hats and putting your parent hats back on, what do you hope that your students get out of Pathways?
Well, I have two students coming, and for each of them, I'd want similar but different things. My older child will be a junior. I've seen him just thrive in project-based learning environments. And when I talk to him about the traditional school environment, he is a completely different person. So really getting him back into that place where he's driving the education and it's not a chore and it's not painful, that's a big piece. For my daughter, who will be a freshman, she's developing that confidence. We've been doing projects and what we're calling spring training all spring and into the summer. She's choosing herself in these projects. She's saying, this is what I want to do. And so it's a way to supplement my parenting by giving her experiences where she gets to push herself.
I have a son who will be a freshman, and I think watching his transformation over the past 2 years and development of Pathways High, as well as him watching our transformation, has been incredibly developmental for both of us. He's a mature 14-year-old and really is enthusiastic and excited about being able to drive his own learning. And I think that was the frustration that he felt in his middle school years, is that there was a lot of jumping through hoops, because that's what has been expected, you know, historically, is we have boxes to check off and hoops to jump through. And he really saw a lot of busy work and couldn't really understand the relevance and how to tie those, you know, check marks to something that he would like to do long term.
I love hearing parents talk about their kids. It's like some of the best, some of the best stuff. And I know I'm kind of overemphasizing the fact that you are the school leaders and also parents, but that is pretty unique, I think. So I wonder, as you've been recruiting families, students and their parents to come to Pathways or to apply to Pathways, do you feel that's been an advantage, being able to talk to parents on their level, but also have that knowledge that you've gained from doing all of these visits and talking to all of these people? And do you feel like that's been something that's helped as you've had these conversations?
Absolutely. I think what has been the most rewarding part of this process is talking to parents, because they have, like us, felt a need, right, for their own child specifically, but they recognize that the one-size-fits-all model of the traditional school doesn't work for a lot of kids. There have been many tears shed. There have been many goosebump moments, I would say, in talking with parents, because they are incredibly grateful. They're incredibly inspired and excited and brimming with emotion when they talk to us about what they feel Pathways High will be able to do for their students, their kids. It is very, I think, powerful, the fact that our children are going there, but also that we have this ability to relate to a need that they have and they've seen as well.
Julia Burns and Amber Regan of Wauwatosa are co-founders of Pathways High School. They spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello. You can read more about it at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break and then learn about her story, one woman's effort to include women's stories in history. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Winston Churchill once said, "History is written by the victors." And for much of our history, those victors have been men.
As a college student, Julia Nussbaum was struck by how writings and recollections from men accounted for most of the historical narratives that dominated her classes. She wanted to change that, so she created Her Story, a blog which invites women to tell their personal stories through their own unique perspectives.
Nussbaum spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the inception of Her Story and its evolution as a digital refuge for female writers.
It came about in kind of a roundabout way, but the play on history is just because I felt like women's stories, and especially like everyday women's stories, sometimes get left out of the history books and they go unnoted. And so it's a way to tell stories of everyday women. And so I thought it would be fun to play on the word history.
When you say everyday women, what do you mean by that?
Women who kind of are the unsung heroes of their own lives. And so we've done stories on motherhood and what it's like to be a mother, what it's like to be a stay-at-home parent. We've done stories on coming out. We've done stories on going on your first date or having your first period, things like that. And we've also interviewed women who have started their own bakery or have created their own successful blogs, or are women who are school counselors who are working with kids every day, just women who are going about their everyday lives, but also leading really incredible stories and have really incredible stories of their own to tell.
So what was the impetus for starting this blog? What happened that you said, this is something we need?
Yeah. So in my last year of graduate school, I was at Vanderbilt and I was doing an internship. And instead of my thesis, I was doing an internship in a nonprofit. And I did it for a year. And the nonprofit is called Thistle Farms. And they work with women who are coming out of trafficking and addiction. And one of the things that they had me do was one of the things they wanted me to do was to get to know some of the women. And so I started a project and I started a writing class, because lots of women had said that they wanted to tell their story. They had gone through this program and now they wanted a chance to tell their stories about what had happened to them. And so I started this writing class, and it was supposed to be a creative writing class, not really a let's tell our stories writing class. It was more of an exercise of like just creating stories and kind of getting your creative juices flowing, because that's kind of what they were asking for. And so we sat down and started doing that, and I was really nervous because here I was with all these women who had these major life things happen that I couldn't understand at all. And I'd never taught a creative writing class before. I'd never done any of that. But I just knew that I liked writing. And a lot of the women at Thistle Farms liked writing as well. So we started writing together. And a lot of what came out of that was they wanted to tell their stories. And I saw this need to say, like, this has happened to me. This is my life. And to have it validated in words and on a page. And while they wrote, I kind of wrote along with them my own story, mostly because I felt like I needed to write with them. I didn't want to just be sitting there waiting for them. I wanted to do the activities with them. And I learned a lot about myself through writing about my family and where I grew up and things that happened to me in my childhood. And so I learned a ton of things about myself. And I thought, women all over have these stories in them, and they have things that have happened to them. They have things that they want to say, and they don't have a place to tell their stories. They don't have a place to say, this is who I am. This is the space where I can be brave and talk about how I came out to my parents. Or I had a story about one girl sent me, and she remained anonymous, but it was about how she had a miscarriage and didn't tell anyone. And so people were just started entrusting me with these stories. And I wanted a place to let women say what they wanted to say. And so that's kind of how, that's a really roundabout way of how her story was formed. But it was really formed out of Thistle Farms and just that need to tell your story.
I think invariably when we talk about women's stories specifically, we get into, you know, so-called feminist territory, and there's always this group of people who say, well, why? Why does it matter? Why don't women have the same opportunities as really the other side of this, men? Why do women specifically need this space to talk?
Yeah. So I was a history major in college, and I took a class specifically on women's history in Europe and then women's history in America. And I kept thinking, like, why is women's history relegated to a class? Why isn't women's history throughout all of the history books? Like, why aren't we learning about these women alongside the men that we're learning about? And that was kind of the first time I realized women's stories aren't told unless we go digging for them. And I mean, some women's stories are told. There are the famous women that we know about. There are the Amelia Earharts and the Harriet Tubmans who saved the day. And there are these classic heroes. But then there's women whose stories we just don't know about, who have been mothering throughout time, who have been taking care of families, but also living these rich and deep lives. And I think that women just don't get a chance to give voice to a lot of what they have to say. And so I wanted to create that space for that voice to come into play. And I did it specifically for women because I do think that men get more of a chance to talk. As a woman myself, sometimes I get talked over and talked to instead of, like, me being able to engage in conversation. So I wanted a place where women could engage in that conversation and engage in community with one another without judgment, without fear of being oppressed or othered. So that's really the space that I wanted to create.
You mentioned you took a couple history classes about, you know, women's history, essentially. So often we look back at history, and part of the reason why women's stories aren't told that often is because much of it is written and formed by men, so our perspective on history ends up being through a male lens.
Yes, and I saw that, well, in the fact that most of my other textbooks were written by men and talked about men. And I think I've always, as a person who studied history, I've always been really interested in the personal stories of people. And when I went through my time at Thistle Farms and really got to know the personal stories of some of the women there, and now that I've done this blog, the personal stories of women are so life-changing and life-giving. And her story has become this community of women who are talking to each other and reading each other's stories and really becoming empowered by one another. I'll do themes once a month, And 1 month we did a theme on pregnancy loss. And women wrote in and told their pregnancy loss stories. And the amount of other women who commented either on our social media or on the blog just saying, you know, I'm so glad you're talking about this issue. No one ever talks about this. No one ever, like, this happened to me and I've been scared to talk about it because it's just not something you say. It's a taboo subject. And so we talk about those open and taboo subjects. We talked about in May, we talked about the purity myth. And that was just kind of talking about a lot of the kids who grew up in the 90s, I think, got fed this line of, like, you have to stay pure, you have to do this or that. And it was specifically to girls. And so we talked about how that sort of was toxic for us growing up. And a lot of women commented and said, you know, I felt the same way. Like, I'm just getting over that. I'm just learning to love myself and love my body after the things that I was taught. So creating that community where women can come together and say, yeah, I feel the same way.
Now, you're moving or you just moved from Tennessee to Wisconsin.
Yes.
And you have this online community. How are you reaching into the Wisconsin community, the Milwaukee community more specifically, and trying to engage them in this project?
Yeah, that's been the hardest part for me. It's been me reaching out and thinking about ways to connect with people. One of the great ways that I have connected with some women is actually after the election, when the Women's March created the huddles. I utilize social media as much as I can because it's all online. And so I utilized the Facebook group that they created and just said, hey, I have this blog. I'm telling stories about women. I'd really love it if you if anyone wants to submit. Here's the information. Here's how you do it. I've only been in Milwaukee for 6 months. And so I'm working hard to try to get into the community. And I'm still looking for that. A lot of my writers still come from Nashville, where I was living before, because I had this built-in community of people that I already knew when I started. Like I said, I do utilize a lot of social media. So some of my writers have found me via Facebook groups that I will post in. So I've had writers from Wales and Australia and Guatemala. So it's really cool to see it, like, all over the world, kind of.
Julia, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much.
Milwaukee-based writer Julia Nussbaum is the creator of Her Story. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. For more information on Her Story, you can head to WUWM.com. That is Thursday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.